Hello, and welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation, the podcast segment of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, artists, musicians, filmmakers, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture, because that's our slogan. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Continuing on our theme of celebrating the 50th anniversary of The Miracle in Flushing, we catch up with Wayne Coffey, author of They Said It Couldn't Be Done, The 69 Mets, New York City, and The Most Astounding Season in Baseball History. The last time we spoke with Coffey, it was for his work on Mets knuckleballer R.A. Dickey's well-received memoir, Wherever I Wind Up, My Quest for Truth, Authenticity, and the Perfect Knuckleball. Now the author reminds us, who were lucky enough and old enough to live through that magical season, what an astounding campaign it truly was. After all, the Mets had been the worst team in the league since they joined the NL in 1962. Coffey explains how Gil Hodges, the manager of the team, and a combination of marquee and marginal players like Tom Seaver, Tommy Agee, Cleon Jones, Ed Charles, and others, broke that loser's yoke at a time when New York City really needed a boost, hence the Big Apple's inclusion in the subtitle. Wayne Coffey, welcome back to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Good to be with you, Ron.
So this is a very exciting time for Met fans, the 50th anniversary of the Miracle Mets of 69, so it must be a great time for you as well.
It is, and it's you don't often get to work on projects, Ron, where you can basically relive the greatest year of your childhood, but that's exactly what I've gotten to do. I pretty much lived and died with the Mets all through that season, and was fortunate enough to get a ticket, scoop up a ticket, and go to Game 5 with my grandfather when they won it all. So it was it's been a blast.
Now let me ask: do you think? Because a lot of the people who write books about things that happened in the past were not around at that point. Do you think that makes a difference?
You know, I mean, there are certainly some eminent historians who have done seminal works on things that they weren't within 100 or 200 years of seeing firsthand. But having said that, I do think that if it didn't actually help my narrative, I mean, it just stoked my passion for the project. And I think to the extent that that happened, it made the book better. It made me just want to just dive into this with all I've had, and you know, and go around the country and track these guys down and really try to tell the story of the human journeys that were behind what we all saw happen on the field. So I do think living through it has and relishing it as a fan it definitely lit my fire even hotter.
Well, when you meet these guys, when you meet your heroes from your childhood, what is that like, especially now, it's 50 years later? Do you get a sense of you wish you almost weren't doing this because now these guys are 50 years older, that they're not the young, strong athletes of those days? And then what does that do to your own psyche?
Well, it doesn't. You know, I don't look the way I did in 1969 anymore either, so you know, we all go through that the aging process, and as the saying goes, it's certainly beats the alternative. But I love being able to catch up with these fellows. I mean, to be in the area called Africatown, Alabama, where Cleon Jones was born, raised, and still lives, the place where the last slave ship ever came to the United States in 1860, and to see him on his tractor and to helping his neighbors and trying to rebuild the community and honor the history of the area. I mean, it was just an incredibly rich experience, and I feel very grateful for having it. And really, across the board, everyone who I had a chance to to talk to, and that was most of the guys. I found it just a treasure, an experience to treasure, really, in every way.
Now, I'm trying to think back, in 1969, I was 12 years old, so...
Well, you were one of those young guys.
So I, at that age, didn't think of these guys as anything other than baseball players. That they didn't have families, they didn't have pasts, they didn't grow up, they just, like, grew out of thin air, and then there they were playing ball. But obviously, you know, one of the things I enjoyed most about this book was that those backstories of where these guys came from and what their experiences were.
Yeah, I mean, we just spoke about Cleon. Another, the story of Ed Charles, who was sort of the, you know, to me, the soul, kind of the inspirational heartbeat of the 69 Mets was... I mean, he, in a very real sense, was kind of the baseball offspring of Jackie Robinson. Ed grew up in just horrific poverty and had all sorts of things stacked against him in his family life, and was homeless for a time as a young teenager. You name it, and Ed Charles went through it. And when he saw Jackie Robinson on the field with his white Dodger teammates in 1947, it was a game, life-changing experience for him. As Ed said, you could see what you dreamed of for your own life right before your eyes. And to hear him tell his story about how that changed what he thought was possible. And then to talk about all of his years in the minor leagues and going through little small towns in the Jim Crow South and not being able to stay with his teammates or eat in restaurants or use bathrooms and just dealing with these horrible indignities and yet holding fast to his dream. And it was just a privilege and an honor to hear him share his story.
Now, obviously, younger readers of this book will find those situations unfathomable, just as, in a sense, of a much lesser serious degree. You get a sense that these guys were a team, that they did stuff together, that they didn't, as the saying goes for other teams, you know, 24 guys getting into 24 cabs and then going their separate ways, that they enjoyed playing with each other, and even though some were... obviously, the stars of the team, even the 25th man on the roster, got a chance to participate and contribute.
I think they were very much that way. And I think it had everything to do, honestly, Ron, with Gil Hodges and the tone he set and the culture he built. I don't think you can overstate how much of what happened in 1969 as a result of the changes and the impact that Gil Hodges had. And it really started with day one in 1968 when he took over the Mets and basically announced in so many words that the laughingstock days were over. You know, we weren't here to entertain people and provide the baseball laugh track. We're here to play ball and win games. And that's really, it was... pretty much a seismic change for how the Mets went about their business.
Do you think, this is a chicken and egg question, do you think he was the influence, or were the younger players like Tom Seaver and Jerry Kuzman, guys who had not been associated with the losing teams of the early days, they came on board and they just didn't want to lose?
I think, it was absolutely both. There was no question. I remember there was... a well-known game that Seaver won in the middle of May in 1969 that got the Mets to 500, 18-18, for the latest date in their history. They'd never been 500 in the middle of May. And a lot of the writers were making a big deal about it, and Seaver basically said, you know, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, we're not celebrating being 500 team. We're not here to be mediocre. And that was kind of a clarion call. So I think you're right. I mean, certainly the arrival of the likes of Tom Seaver, Jerry Kuzman, the emergence of Cleon Jones and now Tommy Agee and Harrelson and Grody, it you know, these were different cast of characters for sure. But all of that said, I still think that Gil Hodges was the man who really did more to create a highly competitive and inclusive culture on that team. And I think the inclusive part of it is really important because he had a way of making everybody feel important and involved and a part of what they were doing. There was no star system, no caste system with the Mets. So the Al Weisses, the J.C. Martins, Duffy Dyers, Jack DeLauro in the bullpen, these guys were, they were an important part of the mix on Gil Hodges' Mets. So, you know, I think all of these things work together to create the change that we saw play out on the field.
Another thing I think that separates your book from other books I've read about the 69 season is the depth in which you go into the playoffs. And it seems that a lot of the book kind of like gloss over the playoffs and go right to the World Series, but your reporting on the playoffs is really something.
Oh, well, thank you. I don't want to go, and I don't think people want to read pitch by pitch, but I'm trying to really almost build a scene, create a scene in people's minds and to take them back and to take them back to Fulton County Stadium when they're playing the Braves in the playoffs and then take them to the start of the 69 World Series with in Memorial Stadium in Baltimore and really kind of just transport them and tell the story in a way that that really brings it to life and not just the game, but the people to life too. You know, it's one of my favorite stories about the as the series was getting started. Ron was when was told to me by Gil Hodges Jr., who was around the team a whole lot that summer. He was about, I think, want to say 17 years old, and he was in his father's office in Memorial Stadium before I think it was the day before Game One. Mets had had a workout, and Gil Jr. was there, and he was studying the stats of the mighty Baltimore Orioles, who won 109 games and were considered by many to be one of the greatest teams ever. And so Gil Jr. is looking at the Orioles' stats and comparing it to the Mets' stats, particularly on the offensive side of things, where the Mets were not just pedestrian, they were really pretty below average. They're across the board in every offensive category, they were near the bottom of the league. They didn't have a 30 home run guy. They didn't have a 100 RBI guy. Their on base percentage as a team, I believe, was 311 that year. And they barely scored more runs than the 62 Mets did. But so Gil Jr. is looking at these stats, and then he says to his father, "Hey, Dad, can I ask you a question?" And Gil Sr. says, "Yeah, sure." And he says, Gil Jr. says, "How are you even on the field with these guys?" And Gil Sr. stands up and he closes his office door and he says to his son, "I don't ever want to hear you say that again. I don't care about the numbers on that page. There are a room full of guys in the next room who think that they can do it. And that's more important to me than any bunch of statistics."
How did ownership look on this? I mean, they'd been used to losing as well, and now all of a sudden they have a winner. And I remember back in the day of the Brooklyn Dodgers, there was a pitcher they had, I forget his name, but he won 19 games, and the press asked him about, "Well, didn't you want to win 20? He says, "No, 19 is fine, because if you win 20, they'll expect it all the time." So now that the Mets have proven to be a winner, did that change the way ownership looked at them and the fans too?
Well, I think there certainly were greater expectations suddenly. I think the ownership, I know that Joan Payson talked a lot. I mean, she was a beloved owner and she just the players were her sons, and they were and she dealt with all of the losing with great dignity and, you know, and apparent good cheer. But she said after they won in 69 that it was, you know, don't kid yourself, all that losing was really rough, and it took a toll on you. And you know, I think, so yes, expectations ramped up, but it was such a different world then, Ron, that I think, and there wasn't this excruciating analysis and, you know, 24/7 news cycles and people getting hysterical about every last thing. I mean, this was a season that was just full of wonder. No one could even fathom what was happening. As the summer went on and the Mets started, they won 2 of 3 against the Cubs in July, and Shea in the middle game of that series was the epic, Tom Seaver's epic imperfect game where he took the perfect game for 8 1/3 innings before it was broken up by Jimmy Qualls. It was magical. You know, Howie Rose may have put it best. He said that, you know, that was the summer of Woodstock, and Howie said every night at Shea Stadium was Woodstock. That's how it felt. It was just wondrous. There was a charm to it, a disbelief. Like, can you believe this is really happening? And you know, I think that emotion that overrode everything else. It just made this deliriously joyful ride for the whole season.
The subtitle of the book is The 69 Mets, New York City, and the Most Astounding Season in Baseball History. Now, you could have easily left out the New York City part, but a conscious decision was made to include it. Why?
Well, we tried to capture a moment in time in New York. It was such a difficult time in New York, and there was this it was a crazy mayoral race that the Mets actually had a pretty big impact on, because Mayor John Lindsay, who had presidential aspirations, was started the year like just getting completely hammered for botching a cleanup of a freak February snow squall that left Queens, almost all of Queens, impassable for 3 days. Then he ended up losing the Republican primary and hitching himself really to the Mets wagon, if you will, and riding it all the way to reelection. But there were a spate of bombings late in the summer by radical groups. There was a tremendous unrest, division among the classes. There was, even as the World Series was playing out, the biggest anti-war protest in American history. So we really tried to capture the mood, the spirit of what was going on in New York, because I think that the response of the city, in a sense, as I told someone the other day, in a sense, this what the Mets did turned New York City almost into Mayberry, because people were just so euphoric about what was happening. It turned this, you know, this roiling, raucous, hard-edged town into a place where everyone just felt almost just really warm and fuzzy inside because of what was going on with the Mets.
I just want to switch gears here a little as we wrap up. You've written books with other people. You've written with Mariano Rivera on his memoirs and Ari Dickey on his. Do you have a preference of working with celebrities in that regard or doing your own work?
They're really very different enterprises, Ron. I've enjoyed the collaborations that I've done very much, and the challenge there is kind of channeling that person and that person's voice and telling their story almost as if they would. I think as a writer, there's it's a greater challenge to put together a whole 95,000 word narrative with your own words and not just talking to someone. And and writing down and shaping, you know, their words into a book. So I really enjoyed both, but probably I think going forward I'd probably be looking to do more things solo rather than collaborations.
Do you have anything in the fires at this point? Or are you riding this one?
Well, I think we're going to be riding this. I hope we're riding it for most of the year. This 50th anniversary celebration will be going on. The Mets are having their official celebration in late June at Citi Field. We've got a couple of ideas that are still kind of taking shape, so nothing's really we haven't gotten liftoff on it yet, but I think we're pretty close, and I wouldn't be surprised if I stayed in baseball. I've written about other sports as well, but I don't know. I think my roots go deeper with baseball than anything. I think it's the greatest sport to write about, and so it's I think that's probably where we'll be looking next.
And we've been talking with Wayne Coffey, author of They Said It Couldn't Be Done, The 69 Mets, New York City, and The Most Astounding Season in Baseball History. Wayne, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Ron. It was great to talk to you.
And that was our conversation with Wayne Coffey. Visit Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, artists, musicians, etc., and also to see who the next guest on the Bookshelf Conversation will be. We hope to have some exciting guests on, including, I don't want to say just in case it doesn't work out, but rest assured that I will be trying to get some very wonderful people to chat with us on the Bookshelf Conversation. Well, that wraps up another episode, so thanks for listening. Have a good week. So long, everybody.
Pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land."